Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Partly cloudy and a very comfortable 57 degrees right now, going up to 77, 79 tomorrow with a chance for showers, 80 on Saturday. But wait, Sunday we start at 70, temperature drops throughout the day. Monday, you're talking about a high temperature in the lower 50s. That's the high. Lows around 37 on Monday night, Tuesday evening, then highs of 59 on Tuesday. So it's going to be chilly for a couple of days. You better remember where you put those jackets and the kids and so forth. Then it goes up to 72 for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And with the weather here, enjoy Monday and Tuesday, because seriously, it's liable to not be that cold on Christmas Day. You're talking about highs of 54 on Tuesday, Monday rather. It could be 70 degrees on Christmas. You never know. Of course, it could be a blizzard, too. You never know. Ryan Griffin joins us now. Rick Griffiths, professor of political science at Syracuse University, recent author of The Disunited States, Threats of Secession in Red and Blue America, and Why They Won't Work. Good morning, Ryan. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Thanks for taking the time with us. I got to tell you, I was saying this before you came on the air. Anybody that is calling for a national divorce apparently has never been through a contentious divorce, because if they had, they would realize the fallacy and the folly of all of this. But let me open the text lines here at 504-260-1870. If anybody thinks there should be a divorce between the United States red and blue states, let me know how you feel about that, yes or no, 504-260-1870. How divided are we when it comes to historical context? Ryan?
Well, we're quite divided. So, I mean, as we know, polarization is quite high right now, and it seems to be increasing. People who study this think that we have not seen this level of polarization since the Civil War era. And one of the concerns is that it seems to be increasing. And so what this article about is just walking through, you know, the potential end game of where that could go. If it just gets worse and worse, what could happen? And that's why some people are calling for a national divorce.
My age is a closely kept secret. I don't even know if the CIA knows how old I am, Ryan, okay? So we keep that under lock and key. But if I were old enough, I would have remembered the late 60s, which was, you know, when I hear about the most divisive time since the Civil War, I think back to the assassinations, I think back to the racial upheaval, I think back to the Vietnam War, I think... You know, those could have been some pretty divisive times in and of themselves. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's true. I won't disclose my age either, but I wasn't around during the late 60s. I imagine that was...
For the record, I didn't say I was. I didn't say I was. For the record, I didn't say I was. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, the people who look at this, and it's hard to measure because we don't have the same polls now that we would have in the 60s, and we didn't have anything like that in the 1860s. All right. But one of the, you know, just one simple difference is they look at Congress and they look at voting records, and they can put them on a left-right scale. Mm. And they can show that the distance between the left and the right is greater today than it was even in the 60s. So that's one way that you could get at that.
And you know what else they didn't have, Ryan, in my opinion? They didn't have 24 hour news cycles. I don't care if it's CNN, Fox, MSNBC, pick one. I don't care. Newsmax, pick whatever one they have out there, where they have to fill with content. Because somebody breathlessly yesterday was talking to me about the New York election and this and that and the other thing. And it's like, well, OK, for the people in New York, I'm sure that's a big deal. And it can be a bellwether for what happens in the future. Personally, I mentioned it. We talked about it a little bit in the news, but I didn't dwell on it because I think sometimes in and of itself, it becomes something to talk about only because you need to fill 24 hours. Neither was there social media in the 60s where people could just jump on and rant and rave and put their opinions on there and sometimes pass them along as facts when in fact they aren't, which means that people believe a whole set of stuff that's not true, which could lead them to think, ah, the United States is so divided, we need a red and a blue.
That's right. That's right. I mean, as a sort of thought experiment, imagine if we could time warp back to the 1960s with the same social media, the same media sphere we have now. That probably would have been an even more turbulent period.
You had a president assassinated. You had a civil rights leader assassinated. I don't know if I'm going in a proper chronological order here. You had a presidential candidate assassinated who was the brother of the assassinated president. You had the civil rights issues that were going on. You had the federal government getting involved in integrating schools. So I don't know, man. I think if you look at it, people don't realize just exactly how divided we were. When it comes to divorce, I said this earlier, anybody that's actually been through a divorce would not want this because there are no winners when it comes to a divorce. For one thing, you got to divide the property up, right? So there's one consideration. You got to divide the kids up, or you got to decide who gets custody of the kids. And I'll make the army, the kids here, who gets custody of that. Do you think people have actually thought through what a divided United States would look like? Because it wouldn't be geographically contiguous, would it?
No. So one of the things I do in the book, you know, on which
tell me about your book. I want to talk about your book as well. Tell me about your book.
Yeah, one of the things I do in there is I did a lot of interviews with, the folks from Red State America, the Yes California, the Texas Nationalists, different secessionist groups. And, you know, the analogy with marital divorce is regularly brought out. And I accept your point. I've had other people say, hey, look, I've been through a divorce. And let me tell you, that was not pleasant. But the argument that, you know, these folks will use and they're always, you know, they're very sincere in their arguments. Is that, look, sometimes you do get a divorce because the two sides just can't get along. And they would have happier lives if they separated and then, you know, built the lives that they wanted. One of the things I do in the book, or really the main thing, is to try to say that the analogy between marital divorce and national divorce only goes so far. Right? In a marital divorce, there's two people. In a national divorce, that's 340 million people. Right. And as you pointed out, trying to sort all those Americans into some sort of red land and blue land, that's folly, right? Because
it is.
I'm looking out in my neighborhood right now out the window. You know, there are Republicans and Democrats and moderates. How do you sort that into two viable countries? I don't know how you do that without tremendous conflict.
I just think talk like that is crazy and dangerous. Am I maybe being overdramatic there or not?
Well, I mean, I'm cautious here. I've done a lot of, you know, I'm a scholar of
society. No, I'm not saying your talk is dangerous and you understand what I'm saying. I mean, people even thinking that would be a possible, even a possibility, I think, is just crazy that people would allow their thinking to go there.
I understand what you're saying. I'm somewhat, not sympathetic, but I try to listen to what the folks are saying. Partly because they usually get to that place out of a tremendous amount of despair and frustration. Mm-hmm. And having studied movements around the world, different secessionist movements, when sometimes people get into a movement and then it becomes their thing. It's kind of like they drink a Kool-Aid and there's a lot of wishful thinking and they really believe in the cause. And it's very difficult to change somebody's mind once they're fully committed to that kind of cause.
Let me take a break here. We'll pick it up when we come back. I will say this. If anyone out there, man or woman, is contemplating divorce, if the first thing the lawyer doesn't say to you is, just so you understand what you're getting into, this is going to be horrible. It's going to be awful for everybody. Get up and walk out because you got the wrong man or woman. That's the wrong attorney. And the other thing I think that has to go with this analogy is that you're not talking about a couple that's been married for a year, right? Or a couple of days where they say, well, this is not going to work out. We've been together a year, no kids, this is not going to work out. You're talking about a couple that's been together for a long, long time and has a lot of assets, and they're dividing this thing up. And it's just to me, having been through a contentious divorce after a long marriage, I can tell you, Professor, is crazy. 622 Traffic Now, WWL. 627, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Professor Ryan Griffiths, a professor of political science at Syracuse University, recent author of The Disunited States, Threats of Secession in Red and Blue America and Why They Won't Work. That book is available, Professor, at Amazon, all the usual outlets?
That's right.
I'm looking forward to reading it. I really am. Let's talk about, somebody texted in and said, I know what it's like to be the product of a divorce and have your parents compete for your attention, and I feel as though that's what's happening right now. Are we kind of on that road now, in a way?
Well, I mean, if things continue, one of the points of the article is that if you continue to ratchet up polarization, right, gerrymandering, government shutdown, you know, there must be limits at which enough people begin to take seriously the idea of a national divorce. Now, you and I may not like that idea at all, but if you push this far enough, it can happen. And there are triggers, you know, a failed election, a political assassination, something like that can tip those sorts of forces over. And if you look at secessionism in other places around the world, sometimes this stuff can move very fast. It can metastasize in just a matter of years. So there are real things to take to be concerned about.
Sometimes I wonder if the political leaders would want this at all, because you got to watch what you ask for. You may just get it, right? And I think sometimes, and I have a very jaded opinion after doing this for a long time, Professor, that, you know, it's almost like wrestling, where they know the outcome before it starts, and you be the bad guy this time, I'll be the bad guy that time. Meanwhile, they have it pretty good, and they want to keep us fighting against each other and it's a very generalized statement, obviously, to avoid us paying attention to what's actually going on. As part of your book, did you talk to any political leaders about this? I know Marjorie Taylor Greene has made some comments.
Now, besides Marjorie Taylor Greene, there is no prominent political leader who's behind this. All right. So Marjorie Taylor Greene periodically will tweet something about we need a national divorce. She did that in the wake of the Charlie Kirk murder. But there is no prominent, there's no Gavin Newsom or J.D. Vance behind it. And if that ever happened, that would be a tremendous tipping point. Mm-hmm. All right. Who I did talk to were just the different leaders of the Texas Nationalists or secessionists in New Hampshire, that kind of thing. But one thing I can say is I've been tracking these groups for over 10 years, and they are gathering, they're gaining momentum. Just a few years back, it was, you know, small potatoes. Now, they're still not like the Scottish Nationalists, where they have nearly 50% of the population on board, anything like that, but they're gaining momentum.
And at any point, Professor, I hate to interrupt you, but we're running out of time. At any point, did the Russians or the Chinese come up in this discussion and what their response would be? House divided
well,
and so
in the
forth?
Book, in the book I write, I open with a very disturbing vignette that walks through a failed election and a disintegration of America. And it ends with the recognition of all these different states in America by China and Russia, who would clearly stand to benefit from that kind of American fragmentation.
Can't wait to read it. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. The name of the book is The Disunited States, Threats of Secession in Red and Blue America and Why They Won't Work by Ryan Griffiths, professor of political science at Syracuse University. We'll talk to Mike Strain when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. All right, 6:46, 14 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Dr. Mike Strain, a respected veterinarian, and he also happens to be the beloved Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, and one nice man. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I am doing great. I've been traveling the state. I'm headed to Nicholls State University to give a lecture on seafood to the Environment and Health Council today. And yesterday, I was in Shreveport at the annual Junior Livestock Sale, the 89th, the State Fair, Louisiana, with our young people, where they're selling their champion livestock. So it's just, we've been having a number of really, really good days. We've been traveling a lot, but getting a lot of things are going on, Tommy. There's a whole lot going on in the world of ag.
Let's talk about the government shutdown, farmers, tariffs, any of that affecting them?
Yes. With the government shutdown, and I've met with Secretary Rollins and with the governor and others, so a number of things. One, that we are reopening all of our Farm Services Agency offices, going to have at least two people in there to get that moving. Secondly, on the SNAP front, earlier this week on Monday, the Department of Health and Hospitals and LSU asked if we could help facilitate to move more money into the food banks. So dollars for food banks come through the legislature, they come federally, they come through our office into the food banks. And we're able to move $1 million in one day, an additional $1 million into the food banks to help them because they're under pressure. Also, as you know, the Louisiana legislature and the governor put a significant amount of money from the budget stabilization fund, which is called the old rainy day trust fund, in order to provide SNAP benefits for children, for the disabled, and in a small group or so, and the elderly. And so, of course, that still left 55,000 people that would not have that. But then we do see now that we hope that those SNAP benefits will be restored, at least partially restored. The amount of money that is being made available through the federal government, that is only enough to last about 2 weeks. So if we can get that 2 weeks worth of money and get those cards reloaded, yesterday, you know, I saw where they were going to provide enough money to the states so that, because it's the states that reload those SNAP benefits. They send the money to the state puts it onto the card, and so we can get that in people's hands, you know, hopefully fairly soon. But many different things in the government shutdown have had an effect, but we are working through them. And again, getting those farm services agencies open is important. But the other thing, many meetings that I need to attend to, our federal counterparts, they've been canceling them. Everything from, you know, dealing with, you know, whistling ducks or whatever the issue is of the day, that those meetings are postponed. So, but time doesn't stand still when you're dealing with whatever issues you are dealing with. And so hopefully that, you know, I was hoping that after the elections on Tuesday, that there would be another vote and then everyone would come together. But I, you know, I think everyone's got their heels pretty well dug in, but I do understand there's some negotiations going on. And at some point, we're going to reopen the government, but the sooner the better, and let's get back to work.
I saw Paul Murphy's story, my friend, at Channel 4 yesterday about the sugarcane harvest. Man, it's going well, isn't it?
It is rolling. I tell you, when you look at that cane, I can tell you 99% of it looks incredible. And with this beautiful weather, this is almost perfect weather. Mm-hmm. You know, we're getting just enough rain to keep the dust settled and keep the cane growing. And they're rolling through there really, really, really well. And price is holding at about 34 cents right now, so that is good. We're expecting a very good cane harvest. Hopefully, we will have it done before the mid of January. And we used to get it done. They tried to always have it done by Christmas Eve. But now with the amount of cane and that we have, it's taken to the first week of January. But you don't want to go much beyond that first and second week, because a freeze is very detrimental to any standing cane that is left. But it's going well. Our cane farmers are pleased. We're very pleased. And I tell you, that sugar program is a very good program. It keeps a stable price. And again, 19 out of 20 years, there's no cost to the taxpayers at all for that sugar program the way that it's done. So sugar is very well. And again, it's probably going to be about $1.4 billion. That's $1.4 billion at the farm, one of our largest crops, dollar-wise. And the largest crop, of course, is timber. And I will be headed back to London with Drax and meeting with the Brits and also with people from the EU on the discussion on the deforestation issue, because they are trying not to buy lumber and timber from the United States because, when I try to explain to them, we are not cutting down the rainforest. Mm-hmm. We have pine plantations.
They can't get that, Mike, that these are managed forests?
Well,
that's why you grow them and then you replant them and then you harvest them every couple of years?
Never confuse issues with motivation, right? What's really going on. Don't let the facts get in the way of what they're trying to do, what they are doing. And so there's protectionism going there.
The only reason these trees, correct me if I'm wrong, are planted is so that they can be harvested for lumber.
Absolutely.
And then after they're harvested for lumber, more trees are planted to take their place, and then the cycle continues. Am I accurate in that?
That's correct. And, they have a short lifespan. These particular pine trees, they are hybrid pine trees, and they grow very rapidly. And we harvest the first time at 12, and we finish cutting them at 18 years. We replant immediately. And so it's very, very carbon friendly. You think the sugar cane's a 5-year crop? Well, trees are a 12-year crop.
And Mike, if you don't harvest, then the trees die, and then you got a big forest fire risk, don't you?
Yes. And what happens? They get sick. They get beetles. They die. Forest fires. So again, you have to cut them on schedule. You have to cut them on time. And we're trying to impress upon our European counterparts and our British counterparts. With Drax, I'll be traveling with Drax so that they fully understand and we move forward. So it's not only about utilization of our wood for energy, but it's also precursor chemicals and other things. So that's our next international trip that we'll be doing, and I'll have some legislators with me and DRAC officials with me. That's the company here that is, you know, and they're actually British, but they're here in Louisiana, and they're a major player in our wood basket.
We got some time till Thanksgiving, November 27th, a little bit later this year, but what can you tell us about Thanksgiving prices, turkey prices, all the other good stuff that we eat at Thanksgiving?
Well, turkey prices have went up significantly. They're up almost 40% due to high-path avian influenza, which has affected a number of turkey farms, even as recently within the month. You know, the overall supply of turkeys is down 5 to 10%, which has resulted in up to 40% increase in the cost of turkey. So we should have enough turkey for everyone, but don't wait until, you know, Wednesday, the day before, to go get your turkey. Mm-hmm. If you're going to buy a frozen turkey, get it now. Pick out, you know, if you like butterball, get that nice butterball, whatever you want right now. And then again, but pay attention. If you got that frozen turkey, it takes about 5 days to thaw it out. You can't take it out of the freezer put it in the oven.
You got to start thawing it in July, I think, right, Mike?
Well, you need about 5 days in a refrigerator. Unless you're going to do it in a sink.
No, you put in your trunk.
In the refrigerator.
Put in your trunk in July. That's what you do. You put
Lord.
Yeah. And then
look, there's already people sick from bad pasta, right? We've already got listeria.
Yes, we don't need that. I'm just kidding.
We
don't need
salmonella and E. coli.
It's just a joke. I'm just kidding. I'm telling the audience that. You would never put a turkey in your trunk in July. I'm just kidding. Hey, Mike, thank you. Have a safe week wherever you travel, whatever you're doing, all right?
Take care.
Appreciate it as always. All right, Mike Strang, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, 655, Traffic Now, WWL. 716, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We're going to have a nice day today. Right now, it's splendid outside, 60 degrees going up to 77 today, 78 tomorrow, 79 on Saturday, which would be a nice day to get out and plant some trees. More on that in a little bit. But first, we're joined by Senator Pat Connick, a good friend of ours, Shaw graduate. How you doing, Senator?
Doing great. Good morning, Tommy.
You are a successful attorney, and I just bring that up because you had to take time away from your law practice. People think that being a state legislator is only during the times that you're in session, but that's not the case. You were in Baton Rouge yesterday for a committee hearing, right?
Correct. We had a joint transportation meeting on several topics, and one of the issues was the Bell Chase Bridge. And that was to inform the House members of how bad this deal was. We had a meeting in September with just on the Senate side with the Senate Transportation. And this was a full meeting of all the transportation members. And they got an earful about how bad things are in Bell Chase when these tolls are on.
They're still working on a damn thing. They had it down to one lane when I was coming to work the last 2 days. I don't know what they're doing. Do you?
Well, the approaches are sinking again. At least one of them is. Mm. And that's a problem. You know, it's not finished, so it's a mess, and we got to figure out how to fix it.
What did you hear from some of the people yesterday, and what did the House committee members hear yesterday?
Well, they were shocked. I think how bad the people are being, you know, hit. They learned that, you know, during the 4 months that the tolls were in effect, they had 5.1 million in tolls billed, but 6.7 million in fees added on to that.
Hmm.
There was testimony from, I think, the young lady.
Not 5.1, 6.7 additional added on to the 5.1 million. That's what you're saying?
That was the fees.
Just the fees alone. So you're talking about a total of 12.8 or 11.8.
Yeah, that was billed, but and the fees were more than the tolls.
That's crazy.
And this toll bridge does not belong in a small community. You know, bridges are designed to stimulate the economy and not destroy it. And this toll is destroying the economy when it was in place. And we heard that from, there's a young lady, House 131, I think it's called. She's a dress shop. She gave a story of a lady came by a dress for $100, and then she got a bill for $50 extra for the tolls because she lived out of the parish.
It's crazy.
And she said, I can't go back at your shop anymore because I can't afford it. Salvo Seafood, Sal testified with his daughter. They did great. And Jonfro's Hardware. Folks testified how their sales dropped tremendously, but since the tolls have been off, they came back up. So that was the message to the governor and to the DOTD people, that this toll does not work in this type of setting. people have to pay. Like Keith Hinckley was there, the president, he testified that, I mean, good points that, you know, if you're going to school, you got to pay a toll. If you're going to the grocery, you got to pay a toll. If you go to go vote, you got to pay a toll. And it just doesn't seem right. And, you know, we're going to keep fighting it and make sure that we're trying to, you know, find a way to pay this thing off quicker.
Sal, talking about the number of homes that are for sale, I'm noticing that as I drive around or walk around Belchase. I don't know if that's a direct cause and effect or not, but there seem to be a lot of homes for sale in Belchase.
You can't live there if you got to keep paying this toll, plus these fees. They were promised 25 cents. It's going to be escalating over 30 years. But no one spoke about these fees that were outrageous. And the other problem that we learned about these fees is that the company never did go through the administrative process to get them set. They just took it from statute, $25, and they started hitting people with that, and it's unconscionable. You know, I learned in law school, you know, that pigs survive and hogs get slaughtered. This company's a hog, and they need to be slaughtered.
Let me take a break on that note. We're talking to Representative Senator Pat Connick. I'm sorry, used to be Representative Senator Pat Connick. We're going to talk about something good going on at Hope Haven on Saturday as well that I may just get involved with. Pat, I might see you out there. You got to tell me what I got to bring, though. 720 traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Senator Pat Connick talking about the bridge tolls in Belchase. I have a toll transponder that I bought because I got a new truck, but I didn't put it on there because the tolls were suspended. I don't know if they're still taking pictures or what, but should I be worried? Should anybody be worried about this, Pat? Or do you know for a fact that nobody's going to have to pay tolls while the governor issued this order and that they are fully suspended, nobody's going to be liable for anything?
Yeah, right now they're fully suspended. They took down the signs and they unplugged the toll system. That's, you know, nobody's going to be charged anything during this period of time. But stay tuned. So,
all right, people that have the charges already, I got a couple of bills that are crazy, and that reminded me as during the break I was thinking, because you know, if you go to Texas, you go through a toll here or there, and you get a bill that's like $3 or something like that, and you feel silly sending them a check for $3, but it's reasonable. That's not the case here. This is crazy.
It is, and I would protest any bill that you have. I can't, you know, to give you
give
advice.
Me legal advice. Hey, yeah, I get.
Yeah,
it.
I don't want to be responsible for somebody getting in trouble, but I would protest it. And I got the same thing. I have a toll tag that I use, and I paid mine, but just to get rid of it. But you know, teach his own on that one.
Yeah, I thought about it. What can happen? Do you know what legally, as far as the state goes, they can do?
I talked to Brian Adams, who's in charge of OMV, and I said they are not flagging licenses. I think they had one or two that were flagged, and the governor stopped that, and so. Your license will not be flagged. This is under a lot of scrutiny. A lot of the charges are not legit. So I think you would have a good argument that I'm not paying it because it's not a valid bill.
And it's not the $20. It's the principle of the thing. You know what I mean?
I think it's both.
Yeah, you know, that's true. For some people it is. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Let's talk about what's going on at Hope Haven, because I think this is a great idea, and I'm really serious about going out there. Are you going to be out there or not?
I'll be out there bright and early. We have 50 trees being donated by Baton Rouge Green, working with Jefferson Parish Parkways. You know, we're looking for volunteers and master gardeners to get this forest planted.
Well, I'm no master gardener. I can volunteer.
We also have some violas that we got from Langridge Plant Sales out of Plaquemines Parish. Mm-hmm. Some beautiful flowers we're going to plant. And if you have not been to this park, it's amazing. It's a gem that not too many people know about, but once you get there, you will see this is something that we need to keep up and grow, and that's what we're doing on Saturday.
Do I bring a shovel? I'm serious here. What do you want us to do?
No, just bring yourself. We right now on Friday, the Parkways is going to be drilling the holes for the trees, mm-hmm. so it's going to be putting the trees out, take it out of the bucket, putting some fertilizer in and plant it and moving on to the next one. We got 50 trees and about, you know, 800 viola plants to plant.
Fertilizer, I'm good at. I sling that all the time.
All right, sounds good.
As well as maybe you can get some friends from Baton Rouge to help you out with that too. Look, where is it that the park is located, and what time should people show up?
8 o'clock to 12 on Saturday.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver. Ready for honest conversations about thriving in midlife? Listen to and follow my new podcast, Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Saturday, it's located on Hope Haven side by Shaw High School. If you go down Barataria, it's 1130 Barataria Boulevard.
Okay. But, It's right in front of Shaw, right? Or on side of Shaw, however you look at it.
It's on a Shaw. If you're coming down the expressway, you take a left heading to Lafitte. It's going to be the right-hand side by the
Don't go to Lafitte. Hang on a second. Don't go anywhere near Lafitte.
That's a different topic. I love those guys.
No, I do too. I'm just saying don't do that because you could be way past it. It's just...
No. Head south and by the Shaw, look for the Spanish colonial buildings and you'll see all the traffic there and come on in and come help.
Yeah, would it bring anything or not? Seriously, gloves, shovels, nothing?
We'll have all that for you.
All right. I'll see you out there, Pat.
All right, thank you.
8 o'clock, you bet. Hope Haven, I'll hit it for you again tomorrow. 11:30, Barataria Boulevard, 8 till noon on Saturday. Be a good chance to get outside, get some exercise, and do some good if you're looking for some volunteer work. We'll talk to Joe Geruso when we come back about the meeting in Baton Rouge yesterday. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 7:44, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly to Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, Tommy. You?
Good. A closed-door meeting yesterday about the bond proposal. I got a piece of paper here and a pen ready. Tell me everything that everybody said, Joe. No, I'm just kidding. Tell me about the tone of the meeting, maybe. That would be a place to start.
Well, the tone of the meeting was really good, and it's funny. I came home and told my wife I shouldn't be surprised at this, but... it's surprising what happens when people who know each other sit around a table and have a conversation. And clearly the relationships that Helena and JP have from having served in the legislature were very clear. And their colleagues, whether it was Senator Henry or Speaker DeVillier, were evident. And look, that freedom also allows good, tough, fair, candid questions from the state leaders about where we are, what our plan is, what the city's planning on doing moving forward. And so the tenor was very collegial, but at the same time, the state had good, legitimate questions that the city needs to answer.
How did this come about? How do we go from, Liz Merle and I talking last week and Governor Landry saying what he had to say to you guys meeting yesterday, everything, again, it was nice to have the grown-ups in the room that knew each other, and that's what it seemed like happened yesterday. I'm just telling you this as a guy watching the news. It was like, you know what? I know a lot of those people that are in that room, and they. It seems like we got the best and the brightest in there and the most mature working on a serious problem. Am I wrong?
Well, look, I'll take it two steps. First is passions run high, and that happens. And a lot of times we get frustrated and say things publicly, and there's tension, and that's normal. That's how this works. The state is wanting to know how we got to this position. We have explanations of how we got there. But I also then think it's like, okay, now that we've gotten it all out of our systems, we've vented, maybe have a little bit of catharsis, now, how do we solve the problem? Mm-hmm. And really, it was Cameron Henry who made two really good points. One is time is of the essence for New Orleans, but the legislature and the state leaders don't know exactly what happened and what the plan is for the future. And so they had questions. And then the second point Cameron made, which again is the one you're asking, is instead of everybody playing telephone and going back and forth, and then this person said that, and it's hearsay within hearsay, let's all get at the same table, be in the same room, look at each other, and ask those questions. So it was a product of all of that work, and really credit to Cameron for making that suggestion and pushing it and getting everybody in the room very quickly.
One thing, and I don't know if you and I have had this conversation or not, but although, you know, there are jokes about politicians lying, this, that, the other thing, the only thing that elected officials have when it comes to the inner workings of government is their word. That's all they have to trade in. Is that accurate or not?
That's right. And the other thing too, Tommy, the more I've done this, politics is a craft, mm-hmm. just like anything else is a craft. And there are just people who are more skilled at it than others. And I'd like to think the people in that room at that table were trying to practice that craft for the best interest of the city.
Yeah, I hope you're right. Tell me what the deal would look like, or do you know yet what it would look like?
Well, I have a lot of the contours of it. The council today is going to pass an ordinance that I'm the lead author on, but every single member of the council is a co-author for, which is we would create a separate fund for which the $125 million would go into. And then this is a little bit of news, but the council would have a weekly meeting. So not twice a month, but four times a month to disperse the funds on a weekly basis to make payroll. And before that happens, there's going to be a series of reports on payroll, on financial obligations that the legislative auditor receives. And we will all sit down probably the Wednesday before the Thursday meeting, pour over the reports, make sure the state, the administration, the council are on the same page. And then Thursday, we'll disperse the money from the fund to make payroll on a weekly basis.
That is some news. So weekly meetings for the council through the end of the year. This would be beginning when, Joe?
We have a council meeting today, but then it would start next week and it would continue. And I'm saying the end of the year probably be through January that we have to do this, because that's I don't know that we'll have our property tax receipts in time to do it, but it will really start the first time next week.
At what point does the cash come in from the bond sale?
It's supposed to be almost immediate, as I understand it. We have to have the mayor sign the bond documents, which I don't think will be an impediment. And then the banking institution is somebody the city already banks with. So we think the money, effectively, in quotes, will be there within 24 to 48 hours of signing the bond obligations.
Where does Mayor Cantrell fit in all of this? You only have one mayor at a time. However, you do have the city council person at large, Helena Moreno, who is the mayor elect, who has the legislative experience, who was one of the grown ups in the room yesterday. She just carries herself like $1 million, as do you and JP Morrell. JP can be, as you said, a little bit bombastic at times, but that's him. That's great. That's okay. What role does LaToya Cantrell have in this?
Well, the mayor has to sign the bond documents, which is an important role in all of this. And the reports that I'm talking about really only can be created through the mayor's office. So it's incredibly important that we have those. And in fact, Helena and I met earlier this week with the mayor's CAO staff and the finance staff to walk through what the expectations would be. And it was a productive meeting. And then we'll have the legislative auditor come in, make sure the auditor is getting the reports that they want, the way they want to see them, what's going on. And look, the biggest thing for me is I don't want a technicality to upset this apple cart. I don't want the state to not get a report or get something wrong, and then they say the deal is off because we didn't dot an I or cross a T. So it's really important that the mayor staff really works well with everybody, and we'll continue to make sure that we're doing all of these things together to make sure that this is smooth sailing for everybody.
Has the current mayor been involved in any of this so far, or is she going to get involved with the signatures that are needed, et cetera, and the work from the staff? Take me through that, Joe.
Yeah, the mayor has been involved with trying to look at additional revenue raising measures. I think that's really her focus right now, concerned about sort of the long-term issues with the city. I think to your point, part of the issue with any handoff is the mayor is the mayor. Mayor Cantrell is the mayor for the next 67 days, and you have the mayor-elect who's coming on board. So how you hand off that baton is going to be part of what we all deal with going forward. And look, we conceivably in years past have passed the budget in sort of the middle to late November. But given how many moving parts there are, so we all continue to work together, it'll be closer to December 1st.
At what point do you know that you'll be able to meet payroll and that nobody will be furloughed, or that as it stands now through the end of this year, people that are employed by the city will continue to be employed?
I think we'll know probably by Friday or Monday. There are some more things, and I'll make a lawyer joke here, saying the lawyer is now we're sort of in the devil's in the details, mm-hmm. and the lawyers are going back and forth on little nits that everybody wants. And I would have to say that I think substantively we're there, but the words matter to everybody. We have to get those right, and hopefully we have that all ironed out Friday.
And Elena Moreno, mayor-elect yesterday, said more to come, meaning?
Meaning that those details that everybody has to agree to need to be ironed out between both sides.
Would you say you were 90% there?
Oh, I think so. Maybe even a little bit closer.
All right, good. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate your time. Any final thoughts? Anything you want to add? I should have asked you and didn't.
Nope, you covered it all.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, 754, 6 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. 8:15 now, we've been asking you for your pets' names. Dr. B, our friend, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. Doc, I know you got a couple of boxes. What are their names?
Yeah, I've got Remy. And actually, we had JoJo, but we don't have JoJo anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had two.
Okay.
I didn't realize. Well, how's Remy doing?
Remy's doing good. He's crazy, like usual, like all boxers.
Well, but that's why we love him, right?
Absolutely.
Well, whether you're newly eligible for Medicare or if you've had it for years, there is a lot to learn about the program, and that's why Dr. B is here from People's Health to talk about four common Medicare myths. So, Doc, I guess, what is myth number one?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of people think that original Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans cover the same services, and actually that's not true. So original Medicare is going to cover all the medically necessary things you might need when you're in a hospital or if you go to your doctor's office or maybe in an outpatient healthcare facility. But what it doesn't cover is those Part D prescription drugs that so many people need, and it doesn't cover routine services for things like dental, vision, and hearing. The Medicare Advantage plans are required to cover all of the services that original Medicare covers, but most of those plans may offer extra benefits as well, and that can include that prescription drug coverage that a lot of people need, and a lot of times they include eyewear, hearing aids. Sometimes they'll have a fitness center membership, and then a lot of them will have a credit that you can use to spend on over-the-counter needs or maybe wellness items.
Are there some other ways that original Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans are different?
Yeah, so original Medicare lets you go see any doctor and go to any hospital that accepts Medicare, and that can be anywhere in the United States. But the Medicare Advantage plans, a lot of times, will have a more narrow network of physicians and healthcare facilities that you may be required to use. You have to stay in network with those plans. And so Medicare Advantage plans may also require referrals to go see a specialist or prior authorization before you receive medical services or some of the drugs that you might be taking. And that prior authorization means that you have to get approval from the health plan before it agrees to pay towards those cost of services. Original Medicare, in general, does not require any referrals or prior authorizations.
All right, there you go. Myth number one, busted. Original Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans do not cover the same services. How about myth number two?
Yeah, so another common misconception is that if you join a Medicare Advantage plan, you no longer have Medicare, and that is not true. You actually do have Medicare, and you have all those rights and protections that come with Medicare, but your Medicare Advantage plan is actually providing the coverage for all of those services that you need, like the healthcare services, the prescription drugs, et cetera. And so at the doctor's office and the pharmacy, you're going to show them your health plan ID card instead of that red, white, and blue Medicare card that so many people will have.
How about myth number three?
Yeah, so another thing is a lot of people think Medicare Advantage plans, because they offer some more services, are more expensive than original Medicare. And that's not necessarily true. That's why it's really important to do your research. So every plan is going to have different costs. It's going to have different benefits. So you have to really look at what your overall cost with a Medicare Advantage plan are going to be. They might be lower than your cost with original Medicare. And the reason for that is because Medicare Advantage plans are actually required to limit your yearly out-of-pocket costs. So when you hit a certain ceiling, a certain maximum in the amount of dollars you spend for health care, it actually stops requiring any payment. Original Medicare does not have any ceiling on that yearly expenses. So if you require a whole lot of services, it can get more expensive.
So the sky's the limit.
Exactly. Okay. It could be.
All right, let's talk about extra benefits. Do the extra benefits make Medicare Advantage more expensive?
No, they usually don't. They usually provide extra value. So, you know, an example would be here in Louisiana, if you go to get your teeth cleaned, just a routine dental exam, they're going to usually do x-rays. It's going to cost about $220 here. If you only have original Medicare, so that's not going to cover any dental services, you're going to have to pay that full $220 out of pocket. But if you have a Medicare Advantage plan that includes routine dental, you won't have to pay that money out of pocket. You may not have to pay anything at all. So if you look at those extra benefits and figure out if you'll use them, the savings can add up. It's really important to look at kind of what you pay on an annual basis to make sure you're not overpaying for anything.
All right, Dr. B, our friend, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, is talking about some Medicare myths and dispelling some of them. For example, original Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans do not cover the same services. Medicare Advantage plans are not more expensive than original Medicare. If you join a Medicare Advantage plan, you do have Medicare. That's not true. It's not true that you don't have Medicare anymore. So we'll pick it up here. We come back. 821 Traffic, WWL. At 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. We're talking about some Medicare myths. Doc, do all Medicare Advantage plans have the same costs?
No, a lot of people think that. You know, some Medicare Advantage plans might have a monthly premium that you're going to have to pay in addition to your Part B premium, and that can vary from plan to plan. And then some will actually have an annual deductible for medical services or medications. And so what that means is you might have to pay a certain amount out of pocket before the plan kicks in and starts covering a lot of those costs. And then Medicare Advantage plans also have different costs for covered services, things you're going to go get, prescription drugs, doctor's appointments. But the costs with those plans most often are going to be more predictable than they are with original Medicare.
And why would that be?
Yeah, so Medicare Advantage plans usually have a copay for any service that you get. So that's a fixed dollar amount that you're going to pay out of pocket. So, for example, going to see a cardiologist may cost you $20. But with original Medicare, the services more often have a co-insurance, and it's at 20% is where it's set. So what that means is if the services, you know, for the physician you see are $1,000, you could pay 20% or $200 of that. And it's going to vary depending on what the doctor does for you, what tests are ordered, and things like that.
I never did get co-insurance because I would be the guy that would be the co-insurer, so I don't understand why they call it that, but they do. How about changing your Medicare coverage whenever you want?
Yeah, you can't do that. You can only change Medicare coverage at certain times of the year. And for most people, the best opportunity is what we call the annual enrollment period, or AEP. That's what's going on right now. That's why you're seeing all the advertisements on TV and hearing them on radio. It started on October 15th, and it lasts through December 7th. And any changes you make during this period go into effect on January 1st.
Is that the only time you can make coverage changes?
In general, it's the time you really need to be thinking about making the changes. It's your kind of one time of year when you can do that. But there are a few exceptions. If you meet certain criteria, you might qualify for a special enrollment period that lets you make changes at other times during the year.
What kind of criteria?
So you might qualify if, for example, you've lost coverage through an employer, like maybe you've retired, for example, or you move outside of the area, the service area where your plan is. So maybe you leave Louisiana, or if you have certain health conditions, things like diabetes and heart disease, you might be able to enroll in certain types of plan. And there are other ones, but the thing to keep in mind, this is really the important time of year where everybody needs to look at their coverage and make sure they get what they need for next year.
It's very important you get this done before the December 7th deadline. I know you guys got that Medicare Center on Vets. Talk about that, if you would, Doc, please.
Yeah, it's a great opportunity for people to come by and actually talk face-to-face with somebody. It's a Medicare Center located on Vets, right in between Trader Joe's and Causeway. And they'll actually talk about Original Medicare. They'll talk about all the plans that are available in this area and available to you. They'll do a side-by-side comparison. And it's a really good way to ask questions, because a lot of this stuff is very confusing.
And appointments are welcome, but walk-ins are welcome. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome as well. It's 3017 Vets. Thank you, Doc. Appreciate it as always. You can find out more about People's Health at peopleshealth.com, or you can always call them at 1-800-978-9765. It's peopleshealth.com, or call them at 1-800-978-9765. 8:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:40, thank you. 20 till 9. One of these days, we're going to talk to Scott Boyle, the District Engineer Administrator for the Louisiana Department of Transportation and Development, just to find out that everything's going fine. But that's not the case this morning. How you doing, Scott?
Hey, Tommy, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me what's going on with this on-ramp and the homeless and the fire and what happened?
Tommy, within the last 9 days, we've had three fires that have occurred under our infrastructure, two of them by Costco, by the I-10 Carrollton Airline Interchange, and one early Sunday morning by the Loyola entrance ramp to the Crescent City Connection Bridge. Mm-hmm. And that one was a very significant encampment fire that we're still determining whether or not we're going to be able to get that ramp back open.
What about the one by Costco? Was it just a fire event and then it's over and the roadway is fine?
Yeah, that one took place last Tuesday. We got a call. We saw pictures that were circulating around 7 o'clock. They had 30-foot flames from on the ground where this encampment was. And they were cresting over the ramp by the airline off ramp from the interstate.
That is 30, crazy.
30-foot flames cresting. If the fire department would not have gotten out there as quickly as they did, we would have had a big problem. This was right near where we just repaired the garbage truck damage from about 2 months ago.
So the U.S. 90 on-ramp by Loyola is the one that's closed, correct?
Correct. That's been closed since Sunday. We got major girder damage. We got concrete deck damage. We got fastener damage. It's at this point, we've analyzed it. We're bringing in a consultant to analyze it. But, Tommy, if this is a significant issue, I mean, it could be months and millions of dollars to get this ramp back open.
And this is all because of a fire that started at a homeless encampment. That's what you're telling me, right?
That's correct. We've gone out there. We saw the remains and remnants of it, and it was, charred tents and sleeping bags and bicycle parts. It certainly was, it just was shocking.
So take me
the amount of damage it occurred.
I'm sorry. Take me through the next steps, Scott. So what happens from here?
So we've gone ahead and analyzed it. We've got a consultant that's looking at it to make a determination if that ramp is safe enough for motorists to drive on it. So right now it's closed indefinitely until we get that okay. Certainly, you know, safety is the highest priority with us. If it's okay, well, then we're going to open it. If it's not okay, we're going to have to do an emergency project. And because this is not just one little element, this potentially could be months of planning and work. And, you know, the price tag on something like this could be in the upper single-digit millions.
And you'll know when, Scott, if it's the damage, is that serious or not? Is there a timeline on it?
Well, we're going to know within the next.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Day or so. It happened Sunday morning, so we've been on it all week. We just... You know, it's complicated. This major girder that holds all the weight from that bridge, it's buckled, and there's different other issues with it. So we gotta do our due diligence, and you know, just to be sure, we don't want to put a car on there and have something worse happen than what's already occurred.
Thank you, Scott. Maybe you can come back. Let us know when you find out. All right.
Yeah, I will. As soon as I find out, I'll call the studio. We'll get that to you.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it. Scott Boyle, District Engineer, Administrator, Louisiana Department of Transportation and Development. Know the homelessness is a problem, but boy, when it starts damaging infrastructure. Let's take a break, come back, talk about a levy district millage renewal that's coming up here on WWL. 8:49, 11 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Jesse Noel, Regional Director for the West Bank Flood Protection Authority, because there's an upcoming millage renewal that's coming up. Good morning, Jesse. How are you?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. How you doing, Jesse?
Perfect. I'm doing well. How are you doing this morning?
I'm all right, sir. Tell me what the West Bank Flood Protection Authority is in charge of, what it is that you all do, and why this millage is important.
Okay, so our mission is to protect West Bank homes and businesses by ensuring that our flood protection system functions as designed. The flood protection system consists of 80 miles of levees and flood walls, 67 floodgates, 35 drainage valves that all have to close for a hurricane. And additionally, it has three large closure complexes on the Nav channels, one in Bayou Signet, one on the Harvey Canal under the Lopalco Bridge, and then the West Closure Complex, which is down south of Belchase, but it really closes in the whole system. And all that stuff has to operate to protect something we're very proud of, $41 billion in infrastructure and 250,000 people that call the West Bank home.
I drive around that area often, Jesse, and see a lot of those different things that you're talking about, and it is quite impressive, but it's not cheap to maintain, is it?
No, sir. No, sir, it is not. You know, we have to exercise it. We have to do heavy maintenance on all of our facilities. So the three closure complex in particular, and then the levees, they continuously sink. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in South Louisiana. We live in a subsiding coastline. And so those levees have to be lifted. And we have an example of that, you know, in Bayou Signet. So right behind the shrimp lot in West Wego, there's a small section of levee. We've spent $23 million in the past 10 years lifting about 18 miles of levee. And so we lifted that small section of levee behind the shrimp lot to about a 14.5-foot elevation in 2018. Mm-hmm. And as it sits today, 7 years later, it's at about a 12.
Wow.
So we lost 2.5 feet of elevation in about 7 years. We're working to get it back up. It's still above the 100-year flood elevation, but we're working to get it back up. We want to go 3.5 feet higher, go to 15.5 this time. But it has to happen on a regular schedule, and that's just one instance. You know, we have 22 miles of levee in West Jefferson alone. And that's what this millage is for. It's for West Jefferson residents, people that live inside the flood protection on the West Bank in Jefferson Parish only. And so they have early voting going on right now, and then the election is actually on November 15th. And they would be voting to renew this millage. So this is not a new tax. It's an existing tax that helps us fund these levy lifts and also major maintenance on our sector gates. So these sector gates are, you know, some of them, the West Closure Complex, each gate leaf is roughly the size of a house, and that house has to swing into the channel to close for a hurricane. And so we need those things to work. We don't get a second chance. You know, when we push the button, it has to work. It's a pass-fail test.
This is not anything new, and I guess I always like to point out, Jesse, what happens if it fails?
If the gates don't work...
No. If the millage fails, well, if the renewal fails.
So if the millage fails, so the millage funds the levy lift program and the major maintenance on our complex structures. And so it would be a big risk. We have to do this maintenance on these structures to make sure that we're repairing them and maintaining them before a storm, right? So we don't get a second chance. And so this money, it's 4.75 mils. It generates about $6.5 million a year. That's 45% of the West Jefferson Levy District's budget. And that we need it to raise the levies. We need it to make sure that the gates are going to work. And if we don't have it, we're going to have to figure out how to do as much as we can with what we would have.
And just to be clear, the whole process, I think what people don't understand is you don't want to put a tax or a millage in perpetuity, because then you can make a case of, well, how do I know that once it's there forever, the money's going to be spent responsibly? So you have it where there's checks and balances and it has to be renewed. But it's an ongoing expense. It's not as though you're asking for any additional money. You're just asking for the money to keep maintaining what's already been built. Is that accurate?
That is exactly right. And so it was a 10-year millage that's expiring in 27. We're just asking the voters to renew it so we can keep providing the best flood protection system the West Bank has ever had. We want to keep it that way, and we want to make it better if we can.
Thank you, sir. Any final thoughts?
So early voting is going on. You can go to the West Bank Regional Library on Manhattan or the Odom Center at the corner of Barataria and Expressway through Saturday, or you can go out on November 15th and vote. We enjoy providing the best flood protection the West Bank's ever had, and we hope to keep doing it.
As a West Banker, I appreciate you doing it. Thank you, Jesse.
All right. Thank you so much.
You bet. Jesse Noel, Regional Director for the West Bank Flood Protection Authority. We'll take a break for traffic now, 855 WWL. All right, 9:10. I probably would not be a very successful coach in college football, and I wish I could get on that buyout gravy train, but apparently it's not as easy as one would think. So we're joined by Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, talk about all of that. How you doing, Matt?
Hey, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on today.
Tell me about the Extra Point newsletter, first of all.
Sure. Extra Points is a publication that covers business, policy, and off-the-field stories that span the entire college athletics industry, from the largest schools in the SEC down to Division II, III, and the NAIA.
And don't forget the Extra Points bowl game.
That's right. Coming up here in just a couple of weeks, this is the second time Extra Points has sponsored a bowl game. We'll be the title sponsor of a Division III game held in beautiful and scenic Canton, Ohio, mm-hmm. at the Tom Benson Memorial yeah. Hall of Fame Stadium, which I think is a really exciting venue when you're playing in Division III and maybe, you know, used to playing in front of stadiums with 4,000 or 5,000 people.
Been there, and it's a beautiful facility, and everybody should go to the National Football League Hall of Fame if you're an NFL fan. Let's talk about coaching buyouts, Matt.
Yes, it's interesting. This time of year, I always get a lot of questions from academics, sometimes even from athletic administrators, and a lot of fans wondering, like, "Oh my God, why are we still having these ridiculous buyouts?" You would think that in this world now, where universities have to directly pay some of their athletes, that this crazy practice of paying a coach tens of millions of dollars not to be there would begin to go away. Mm-hmm. And based on how this current hiring cycle is going, that's absolutely not the case. There is a real chance that by the end of this football season, there will be on paper $200 million across FBS allocated for coach buyouts. We'll see the real number. You know, depending on revenue offsetting, or might be a little bit less than that, but it's still going to be a record, and it's not terribly close.
So how does this keep happening?
So it keeps happening right now because none of the individual incentives are set up in a way to prevent it. If you are an administrator at a place like LSU or Florida, you don't get promoted. You don't get a contract extension or parade for being fiscally responsible. You get promoted and celebrated and have security if you hire the coach that the major boosters want, or if you're able to cut down nets or raise trophies. Mm-hmm. And that means that you are incentivized to do whatever is absolutely possible to get your guy and be able to tell your constituents that you did it. And, you know, in 5 years, either you're off to a better job, the coach is successful, nobody cares about the buyout, or you're both fired. Like, there's no way to really mitigate that risk very easily.
Is it primarily football?
The gigantic buyouts are primarily football, mm-hmm. not exclusively. You generally don't see 7-8 year contracts in men's basketball. There are a couple of exceptions. John Calipari moving from Kentucky to Arkansas after essentially being granted tenure would be an example. Mm-hmm. You see high salaries for other sports, but you generally don't see the long contract length anywhere else but football.
So I'm looking at your story here about Hugh Freeze being hired on the basis of his offensive accomplishments almost a decade ago.
Yeah.
Is Hugh Freeze likely, you know, I guess he's going to ride out the buyout? I don't know. Sometimes the buyouts are phrased where if they take another job, either in broadcasting or in let me ask you first. Yeah. So how are the buyouts structured? And then we'll go from there.
Sure. So buyouts can be structured in lots of different ways. What you're describing right now is something that's called a duty to mitigate. It's in some contracts, for this cycle, I think most prominently it's in James Franklin's contract at Penn State, saying that, yeah, we'll pay you your salary throughout the duration of your contract, but if you get another, you have to look for another job. Mm-hmm. And the difference between your new job and what we were paying you, that's what we'll actually pay you. But that's not in every contract. I believe Hugh Freeze does not have that. Billy Napier, when he was fired from Florida, did not have that. Buyouts can also be structured differently for how much money is due immediately. You have some contracts, I believe off the top of my head, this is the case with Coach Stoops at Kentucky, where the entire remainder of the buyout is due within 30 days. Mm. With Jimbo Fisher, when he was let go at Texas A&M, there was a lump sum that was due immediately, and the rest can be prorated out over the length of the contract. Sometimes it's spread out even more than that, which is important because then that determines, do I got to ask my boosters or, you know, raid my coffers for $32 million in the next month? Or can I kind of spread this out over 7 years where I know if my TV money is going up or if my ticket sales go up, it won't be that big of a financial sting.
So do you think it's likely a guy like Hugh Freeze does this all over again, gets another job? Because I guess the question is, why does this cycle, why do we lather, rinse, repeat? Why are these people why do they continue to get hired? Is it because of, in essence, monopolies by agents? There are only so many to go around. Is it because schools are so desperate? Talk to me about that.
There's a lot of different reasons. And part of it, you're right. There is a quasi-monopoly on established, experienced head coaching talent where really three or four agents represent almost everybody in that world. Part of this, and it's just God's honest truth, is that hiring head football coaches in America is not a complete meritocracy. It is a world where who you know and who you're connected to and who you're tight with particular boosters matters quite a bit. And so people that are really well connected in this industry are more likely to get third or fourth or fifth chances than some folks who might not be. It's kind of funny because, you know, it's easy to joke about, oh, my God, if you and I, if we got $20 million, you wouldn't ever hear from me again. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't keep writing my newsletter. I'd move back to Brazil and I'd send you guys a nice Christmas card. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of these coaches and ADs, this is so tied to their personal identity. It's what they've done their entire life. And there is an ego component to it that they don't know what else to do. And I think people point to someone like Bear Bryant as an example who, died less than a year after mm-hmm. he finally retired. That no matter how much money they're getting, they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it for the adrenaline rush of winning and running a program.
And I guess maybe TV can offset that. I don't see Nick Saban coming back to coaching, do you?
No, I don't. And Nick Saban's also not 46 years old. Mm-hmm. Nick Saban did the bulk of his career doing it, you know, in a different era. And it's also hard to compare anybody else to Nick Saban because he's been the most successful head football coach in really college football history, certainly modern college football history, because he's cut from a different cloth. But we can look at lots of other people, whether that's Freeze, whether that's Dan Mullen at UNLV now after doing a little bit of television. I wouldn't be surprised to see Pat Fitzgerald or Paul Christ or a number of other coaches who we left, you know, a couple of years ago get head coaching jobs this cycle. People tend to get kind of just like in the NFL or the NBA, they tend to get recycled.
People don't realize Bear Bryant, you bring him up, was only 69 years old when he died. Of course, those Chesterfields without the filter didn't help him any.
The Chesterfields didn't help any. I can't imagine Bear Bryant got a whole lot of sleep during the football season. A lot of stress, a lot of travel. I would say, having been on this beat here for a while, for athletic directors and college football coaches, it's a lot of core morbidities because they are associated with an awful lot of unhealthy behaviors. It's not a gig where a lot of these guys live to be 90.
So it would seem to me, if you're going to have a monopoly, a quasi-monopoly, however you want to refer to it, on the part of the agents, a de facto monopoly,
sure,
on the part of the agents or the, you know, the small world with the coaches and so forth, and maybe with the athletic directors, you would think that maybe those in charge of the universities could create their own de facto monopoly and say, well, you know what? No, we're not going to pay it. We're just not going to do it. We're going to be fiscally responsible. We're not going to give this guy a fifth chance after 18 buyouts. And I'm making my numbers up here, but you understand what
sure.
I'm saying. But the likelihood of that is not going to happen.
I don't think so, because I don't think fans and constituents would stand for it. And like, let's use a local hypothetical here as an example. You know, to kind of riff off of what your governor was talking about here a couple of days ago, let's say LSU hypothetically states, we're not going to play this game. We're not going to get taken to the cleaners by Armstrong and Jimmy Sexton anymore. Mm-hmm. We're going to go hire the best coach right now from the Southland Conference. We're going to pay him $3 million a year. And if he makes it to the semifinals of the college football playoff, we're going to bump him up to $12 million a year. We're going to put some of that difference into NIL, and we're going to save the rest of it. And we're going to try to drive the prices down. And by God, this is LSU. We have so much talent in the 504 and across South Louisiana mm-hmm. that we don't need to pay somebody $12 million. And on paper, everything I just said is true. And I think you probably could bring in somebody from a good Southland program and have them win football games here.
But
second, yeah, well, go ahead.
No, I sense there was a big but coming. That's why.
There is a big but. I think if you do that, and the second that coach loses to Ole Miss or Texas A&M, by God, there's going to be a state house congressional inquiry.
Mm.
And whoever is the chancellor or whoever
signed off on that. But wait, not the state house congressional inquiry into Brian Kelly losing to Ole Miss or Texas A&M.
Yeah, I don't think that person would get the benefit of the doubt, because fundamentally there's so much financially riding on LSU football being successful, not just in selling beer and popcorn and parking spaces, but in hotels and licensed revenue and what that means for Congress people here in Louisiana, that I don't think anybody would be willing to risk saving some money and hiring somebody who's not on paper more of a sure thing. It's a difficult political pill to swallow. And if you're wrong, you're not going to have a future in this state. And I'm not picking on Louisiana, right? I'm from Ohio. God knows it's the same thing if Ohio State did this. Mm-hmm. You would get run out of town to Michigan immediately if you tried to go if they had hired another guy from Youngstown State and it didn't turn out like it did with Jim Tressel.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 9:21, talking to our friend Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. We'll talk about the House settlement. We'll talk about name, image, and likeness at the expense of buyouts and more when we return. 9:21, Tommy Tucker, you got any questions? 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along. Somebody texted in and said, growing lists of schools think or hope they can buy a national championship. There's only one each year, but how do you measure success? Is it just getting into the playoffs? Is that it? Because I don't think the conference championship really means anything anymore unless they'd get you into the 12. 9:21, traffic more. No traffic, just a break. WWL. 9:28, talking with our friend Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, about these coaches' buyouts. And, you know, I'm looking at your story here at extrapoints.com about buyouts, more proof that money isn't real, and we'll get to the real nature of money in a second. But I think it's Hugh Freeze's contract I'm looking at here, paragraph 22, termination other than for cause should the university elect to terminate coaches' employment other than as outlined in paragraph 21. I don't see what paragraph 21 is, but I don't know if that's about bad behavior or what, but could they not write these contracts as, tell you what, if you don't win blank amount of games in season one or two or three or take us here or there or whatever the expectations are, that is cause and you get no buyout. That would seem common sense to me, but of course common sense doesn't always lend itself to reality.
Right. When any of us, whether you're Hugh Freeze or Tommy Tucker or Matt Brown or somebody, you know, working down at the plant, when it's time to figure out your employment contract, you get what you can negotiate for. Mm-hmm. And if a school said, all right, Mr. Freeze, your contract says that you need to win an average of 8 games over a year, over 3 years, or you're fired with no buyout, Mr. Freeze would just say, but the Florida job doesn't require that. Mm-hmm. Or any of these other 11 jobs, including some schools who really want me to come over, so I'll just take that one. And then you end up with your fifth or sixth choice, and your fans scream at you, even if you ended up saving the money. No, everyone is afraid on the school side of the desk to take that kind of hard line.
This is where the ridiculous nature of it comes in. When a CEO is hired for $50 million, why? Because I'm going to save the money company. Well, the first thing would be if you work for $49 million, that would save the company $1 million right there. But
yeah,
moving, that's a company. Let's talk about coaching. It's like, well, you're coming here, and you want me to pay you all this money because you're telling me you're going to take me here and you're going to take us there and we're going to win this, but you don't want to base your employment on that. You don't want to base your contract on that. You want me to take you at your word, but you don't want to sign your name to the deal that would affect your compensation.
Sure. And I think if you're a football coach too, I think it's also fair to point out that as a coach, you can control process. You can control to a large extent what kind of athletes are part of your program. You can control what kind of scheme you run, how well you prepare people. But we're dealing with 20-year-olds mm-hmm. who are not necessarily the most consistent or stable people anyway. And football is a funny game. The ball is shaped funny. It bounces kind of funny. And you can't completely control results, which is why, and it's kind of a similar thing here. Like when I sell an advertising package, I don't tell somebody I'm going to guarantee you're going to sell 15 units. If you run an ad here with Extra Points, I can guarantee you the process. Mm-hmm. I can guarantee you a certain number of impressions, but I can't guarantee the results. And I would be distrustful of somebody who does. And I can understand why a coach, particularly in the SEC, would say, I wouldn't be comfortable with that. Not that there aren't ways to prevent a Brian Kelly situation. Mm-hmm. You know, they gave the guy a 10-year deal. That's crazy. I wouldn't give professors a 10-year deal. I don't think you should give anybody tenure, but particularly not an SEC football coach.
So what is the going right now for LSU? Say, for example, if they were to try to, and Tim tells me that Joe Brady, I think, is the betting favorite as it stands now. Who knows what that means? Or Lane Kiffin, would they be looking, if Brian Kelly got a 10-year deal, would they be looking at a similar thing with a similar buyout? Because it seemed as though Brian Kelly kind of set the market.
I don't think that a 10-year deal, even for a big-time head coach, is really the market. That was okay. An unusual thing that Woodward offered to pry a guy away from Notre Dame, which mm-hmm. is typically a hard thing to do. But I would be looking at a base annual compensation for an SEC head football coach to be in the neighborhood of $9, $10 million a year easily and with a fully guaranteed buyout. Can you negotiate fully guaranteed subject to offset? Yeah, probably. But I would imagine something in the $10 million 6 year, $60 million total comp as like a bare minimum for this kind of job, especially because of you're entering the market at the same time that Florida and Penn State and Auburn and potentially other really big time schools are. You're likely to be fishing in the same ponds.
When it comes to name, image, and likeness in universities paying players and so forth, is there only, I know you talked here about money not being real, but is there only so much money to go around when it comes to donors, when it comes to boosters? If you're buying out this guy's contract, then you don't have the money for name, image, and likeness. Or for those in that upper stratosphere of income, money is not real and it doesn't matter. Whatever you need, I'll give you.
I think, honest to God, it's really more of the latter for a program like LSU. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there are that many donors or boosters for a Tulane or for a Tulsa or UTSA to whom money is no object whatsoever. And certainly the concept of donor fatigue is real everywhere. If you're LSU and you're trying to do athletic fundraising for anything, you're not just hitting up three Entergy officials who have a gajillion dollars. You're mm-hmm. hitting up a lot of people who are making $200,000, $300,000 and are just regular old rich people. And those folks don't, eventually will tell you no. But when the price of success in a place like the SEC or the Big Ten becomes more and more expensive, I am inclined to believe from the data that we've seen the last 5 years that there's always another rich guy. And we're not close to the point where even an LSU or a Florida or Ohio State will say enough. There's enough people with enough money out there that it's, hey, we need to make a change. I will write a $40 million check to get rid of Brian Kelly. I promise you that money is not coming from Louisiana school children or pensions or road funds. There's somebody in the state or two somebodies who will cover it.
And the other point is it's not going to affect their life. It's just a number. It's just a check. Yeah. They're not going to miss $40 million, right?
No,
as crazy as that sounds.
Not only that, but if they give that to the LSU Athletic Foundation or the university, not only are they not going to miss it, that's a tax write off. As ridiculous as this sounds, like helping to offset some of these sorts of things counts as a charitable donation. It probably shouldn't, but that's the way things are structured right now. For you and I, if our favorite football team increases prices by 9% and adds an extra dollar for a beer, we're going to feel it. Mm-hmm. But there is a class of people, the Larry Ellisons and Michigans of the world, for whom, no, it's just a number, and I value the success of this team more than I do this eight-figure check.
But even at that, and we'll take a break and pick it up here when we come back, that doesn't guarantee success.
You can't buy success, right?
Nope.
And for all the advantages and all of the budgets and all of the geographic built-in help that a place like LSU has, there's 10 other LSUs. And to your caller's point, before the last segment, only one team can win a national championship.
And there's only so much talent to go around. There's only so much.
The funny thing about football, there's a winner and a loser in every game.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to our friend Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, 504-260-1870. If you got any questions or comments, we'll continue the conversation when we come back. It ain't like it used to be, I'll tell you that. Traffic now, WWL. 944, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. So, Matt, when it comes to, let's take a step back and talk about the salary cap when it comes to college sports, name, image, and likeness, and is there so much money to go around, or how has that changed the nature of recruiting and the market for college coaches? That's a big, long question, but take your time.
It is. What I would tell people is that where we are right now is we have a soft cap in athlete direct spending. If you have $20.5 million that universities are allowed to directly allocate to athletes under the terms of the House settlement. Some of that won't end up being cash. That will end up being expanded scholarship opportunities across the department. And schools have to figure out, all right, how much of that needs to go to football versus basketball, versus women's basketball at a place like LSU or Tulane, how much needs to go to baseball. But you can exceed that number through marketing deals. There's a whole clearinghouse that's supposed to approve them to make sure that they're actual marketing deals and not, donor-funded money laundering. But since that is taking a long time, lots of schools are bypassing the clearinghouse. Nobody's really been punished for sending fake deals to clearinghouse. There's not really strong enforcement of that world right now, in part because people are worried about being sued. So it's not uncommon to see football alone have payrolls that exceed that $20.4 million. And it means that recruiting, which was always transactional on some level for elite talent, has become much more explicitly transactional. It's not exclusively. Mm-hmm. Money is not the only reason anybody makes any kind of decision, just like it's not the same reason for why you and I work where we do or your listeners work where they do. Money's a factor. It's not always the only factor. But that's very much a consideration here for building football, basketball, and baseball rosters. And the schools that are going to be really successful moving forward are not just the ones that spend the most money, but do the best job of retaining the right talent and efficiently deploying that money, just like it is for the NFL.
So somebody texted in and said, how much would I have to, if I called the National League WWL, come work for me in my loser town and loser station, what would I have to put in a contract? Well, I wouldn't leave. So, because I'm a loyal kind of guy, but somebody, and then they texted back and said that the price just got higher. That is what most coaches say to run the price up. I'm not trying to run any price up. I'm being sincere about that. But is there any loyalty anymore when it comes to either coaches or players to the university itself? Or is it all about what I can get, give the money, show me the money?
I, again, I don't think it's exclusively money at every single place for every single kind of situation. There are definitely examples of both players and coaches that will say, I will take a pay cut relative to what I could get on the market because I like where I am, or because I like my boss, I like my coworkers, I like our team. You know, not every good player leaves from the G5 or leaves from, you know, Purdue or Duke every single year. But even that being said, even if you're a loyal person, for all of us, there's a number where it becomes generational or life-changing in so many ways where you would have to have that conversation. I don't think reasonable fans would begrudge a 19-year-old, particularly one that doesn't come from money, mm-hmm. who might not be getting a revenue share 1 year, and if somebody offers $1.5 million, almost everybody would say, yeah, I have to take it. But there are definitely people that are like, no, if I'm making 700 here and this is a religious school and I like that ecclesiastical mission and the French bread north of Louisiana sucks and I want to stay here. And yeah, that absolutely does happen.
Give me a snapshot of where college sports are today as opposed to the days of Keith Jackson. Well, maybe that'd be more than 10 years ago, but maybe 10 years ago, and where you think it's going to be 10 years from now.
Yeah, I think that the biggest change, even from 10 years ago, I would say that college sports was still a big money business. Your schools, particularly major conferences, were playing for big money television contracts. The ESPNs and Foxes and CBSs of the world still had enormous sway. Tickets were not $6. But all of those pressures have only increased exponentially over the last 10 years. And part of that is because there's more money coming into the ecosystem from cable, now from gambling, from a larger multimedia rights world. And now there's more pressure to directly share some of that money with athletes. The going rate for a bag man in the SEC 10 years ago is way lower than the going rate for securing a commitment for a really good football player now. And absent federal
law. Wait, say that part
changing,
again?
Yeah.
Say that part again.
Before NIL, right? Yeah. If you were trying to convince
a four-star
high schooler, yeah, you'd have to pay them under the table. We call that right. The bag man.
Sure.
The amount of money that it would take 10 years ago is way less than it's going to take now.
Mm-hmm.
Because now there's institutional capital that's flowing in. And the schools themselves are able to say, we're going to carve out a chunk of that ESPN check we get for the SEC network, and we're going to pass that along to some linebackers and defensive ends, which you couldn't do a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Absent a federal change, a federal law change, or some enormous market crash, it's difficult for me to see that trend slowing down or going backwards in the next 10 years.
So it would get a lot bigger. Worse?
Well,
the bigger would get bigger and the smaller would disappear?
There would be a bigger gap between the bigger and the smaller.
Okay.
And college football in particular, I think that gap is already enormous, right? Like, I don't know when the last time a Sun Belt school was meaningfully recruiting against LSU.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's happened really since the 70s. In this world, yeah, it's gonna be even less likely. The idea of Tulane and LSU going head to head for a guy that they both want, like that might have been different in the 60s. It's definitely not going to be the thing here now.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's worse, I think that would depend on the eye of the beholder. If you're an athlete, that might be better because you're going to get more money. If you're an agent, you think that's great. If you're a coach, maybe you're kind of ambivalent. Depends on where you're coaching. But I absent some structural changes, it's hard for me to see that going away.
Is there any evidence or is it just anecdotal about regions? Do players tend to like to stay with the regions, or will a guy from Louisiana go to Oregon if the money's right, or a guy from Oregon go to Mississippi if the money's right?
You know, there actually was some peer-reviewed research that we've published on Extra Points before about athlete choice in the pre-NIL era.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from the papers that I've shared, there was a pretty strong correlation between region. You know, like one of the most important ways to predict where somebody would go would be proximity to home.
Mm-hmm.
It is different now. It's not 100%, but if the money is right, it is much easier to get somebody from Oregon to come to LSU than it might have been 10, 15 years ago. But region does matter. And I would say that, like, the amount that region matters is a little bit different. It's going to be a little bit easier to peel somebody away from Connecticut because that guy's probably never really considering UConn than it might be to keep peeling somebody away from the I-10 corridor to get him to go to Iowa or Wisconsin or North Dakota.
Tell me real quick about your study you did on alcohol.
Yeah, it's a funny thing in this market, right? Because the idea of selling alcohol at a sporting event in South Louisiana is not some new or novel thing. Mm-hmm. But the rest of the country is just now starting to catch on to that trend. And now it's almost everywhere you can buy some kind of adult beverage. I filed about 40 open records requests about a month ago to try and get both revenue data and unit sale data for a wide variety of institutions. And I'm doing this again now across the country to see who sells the most. And despite, you know, LSU's reputation, I think, or South Louisiana's reputation as a culture where drinking is a part of the social fabric, they were not number one.
No.
They were not number one in total revenue or in total units sold or anything.
That who was?
Based on the data I have, that would be Nebraska. This is the first year you can buy a beer in Memorial Stadium. Nebraska Stadium is not as big as Death Valley, but as somebody who has lived in Louisiana and is from the Great Lakes region, I will tell you that when it comes to beer consumption, the Great Plains and Northern Great Lakes region, I think, really does stand apart from everywhere else, even our brothers and sisters in Tennessee and Georgia.
Matt, a pleasure as always. I appreciate it. Tell people again about the Extra Points newsletter, how they can get it.
You bet. Friends, if you're interested in what your AD is reading, what your conference commissioner is reading, what your professors are reading, and the smartest fans at your tailgate are reading, you can find that at extrapointsmb.com, Matt Brown EP on Twitter, and Matt at extrapointsmb.com for email.
Pleasure as always, sir. Thank you.
Of course.
We'll talk to you again soon. You bet, Matt Brown. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we return here on WWL.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, a board-certified OBGYN and menopause specialist. My new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it really takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Every week, I sit down with medical experts, cultural icons, and powerhouse women to talk about what really matters, your health, your power, and your future. We're covering hormones, identity, finances, relationships, and so much more. New episodes drop every Tuesday. Listen to and follow Unpaused with me, Dr. Mary Claire Haver, available now wherever you get your podcasts.